Chapter 9. What you eat in private, you wear in public. It would seem that optimizing serotonin availability and action at the 1A receptor is the neurochemical key to contentment. Indeed, it is. But producing adequate amounts of brain serotonin all the time is hard to do and even harder to maintain. No wonder many of us are unhappy. Our current drug armamentarium is pretty sparse and fraught with tendencies to overshoot along with mental health dangers that come with it. Everything from severe irritability to bad trips to suicide. And these many medications from your doc, shaman, or college roommate are not actually making serotonin. Some antidepressants and hallucinogens are acting as serotonin agonists or chemical mimics. The natural stuff is up to your brain to make. And for that, you need the basic ingredients or building blocks. For serotonin, that would be tryptophan, the basic ingredient to inner contentment. But our food supply isn't doing us any favors either, given that 1. The precursor amino acid tryptophan is the rarest amino acid in our diet. 2. Ingested tryptophan can be metabolized by an alternate pathway in the body called chiuronine, which can create inflammatory byproducts leading to worsening of your health. 3. 99% of the ingested tryptophan is converted to serotonin in other parts of the body, used for other functions in your gut and your blood, before it even gets a chance to be transported into the brain. 4. Tryptophan transport from the blood into the brain is in competition with much higher concentrations of both tyrosine and phenylalanine, the precursors for dopamine, for that same blood-brain transporter. 5. The serotonin that is manufactured from tryptophan elsewhere in the body can't gain access to the brain because it can't cross the blood-brain barrier. 6. The serotonin receptors are virtually everywhere throughout the brain, so there's a big demand for that small supply. And 7. The enzyme that inactivates serotonin, that is MAO, that ubiquitous Pac-Man, is very good at its job. It's no wonder we're unhappy. We're always playing catch-up. Most of us are functionally serotonin deficient some of the time, a state, and some of us are serotonin deficient all of the time, a trait, both of which can influence clinical depression. There's barely enough serotonin in the brain to generate even a fleeting feeling of contentment in the first place. Eating for sleeping. Serotonin is known to prepare you for sleep and influence sleep stage cycles, especially by reducing the active or rapid eye movement phase and increasing the slow wave or inactive phase of sleep. If you give tryptophan, the precursor to serotonin, to normal, non-depressed people, you tend to see some lethargy and sleepiness and decreased reaction time. Perhaps this is one of the reasons people blame the tryptophan for falling asleep at their Thanksgiving turkey dinner, besides stuffing yourself with stuffing, mashed potato, pumpkin, and pecan pie so you can't move. Conversely, if you provide adults with a tryptophan-depleting drink just prior to bedtime to reduce their brain serotonin, their sleep looks like people who have untreated clinical depression and which keeps them awake at night. SSRIs, while they treat symptoms of depression, also push the reset button on your sleep cycle, often with the result that you can't sleep or that you sleep too much. Thus, the tryptophan in your diet goes a long way toward determining how well you sleep, and how well you sleep goes a long way to determining your level of contentment. Our increased levels of sugar and caffeine in the diet sure don't help matters any. We're wired from Red Bull and Starbucks Frappuccinos, making us even less likely to get regular sleep and wreaking havoc on our metabolic systems in general. For instance, a study of 4th and 7th graders shows a correlation between shortened sleep and soda consumption, although we can't determine if this is due to the sugar or the caffeine or both. More on the role of sleep in unhappiness in Chapter 10. While there are several steps involved in converting the tryptophan in food into serotonin within the brain, most of us don't get enough dietary tryptophan in the first place. Eggs and fish have high concentrations of tryptophan, nuts and poultry are not too far behind, and spinach and soy make the list as well. Although, beware, just because they're advertised as chicken McNuggets doesn't mean there's any chicken in them. Indeed, many people who are egg eaters and fish eaters have the highest levels of tryptophan consumption as measured by blood concentrations. Of course, looking at levels in the blood doesn't mean that any tryptophan actually made it into the brain, so it's by no means a perfect marker. Fish consumption is inversely related to depression in large meta-analyses, although we don't yet have cause and effect. But eggs are frequently omitted from certain processed foods because they curdle with time, because they can go rancid when not refrigerated or when they're old, and because enough people are allergic to eggs. And fish is not usually a big seller as an ingredient in processed food, in part because certain fish don't freeze well, and most people want to see the fish to determine how fresh it is. The nutraceutical industry is actually peddling both tryptophan as well as the next step chemical intermediate on the way to making serotonin, called 5-hydroxytryptophan, in capsule form. Currently, randomized placebo-controlled trials of these nutraceuticals to improve depression are early and limited. One group performed a double-blind placebo-controlled trial giving tryptophan to a bunch of petulant people, and lo and behold, they got nicer. Maybe slip some tryptophan in your boss's coffee tomorrow. A meta-analysis does argue for some benefit in depressed patients, with some attendant side effects. However, Big Pharma is not interested in going down this road because a tryptophan pill is not patentable, and they can sell SSRIs and charge a bundle. We really don't know what a tryptophan replete America would look like. What's your beef? What about red meat, which is supposed to provide high-quality protein? America prides itself on its meat production and its meat consumption. Does red meat have enough tryptophan? Well, it does, but let's have a look at the difference between the corn-fed beef of processed food versus beef that came from cattle that were grass-fed. Turns out that corn is relatively deficient in tryptophan, but is loaded with phenylalanine and tyrosine, the precursors of dopamine. While contested by the processed food industry, it is likely that we who eat these animals are not getting very much tryptophan. Furthermore, corn-fed beef has higher levels of branched-chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, and valine, that contribute to liver fat, which drives the metabolic syndrome. Chicken is the one processed food staple that contains a reasonably high quantity of tryptophan. But there's a big catch. Chickens raised for the processed food industry are corn-fed, just like the cattle, and contain a lot of branched-chain amino acids as well. Each of these amino acids is essential, which means you have to eat them. Your body can't synthesize them. Branched-chain amino acids account for over 20% of all the amino acids, which are building blocks, in the Western diet. If you're in puberty or a bodybuilder, then these branched-chain amino acids are necessary for building the proteins that are found in muscle. And that's what's in protein powder. But if you're a mere mortal like me and most of the sedentary world, then chowing down on excess branched-chain amino acids means there's no place to store them, which means that the liver has more of these amino acids to process and metabolize into energy. The energy overload in the liver drives fat accumulation and insulin resistance, promoting all the chronic metabolic diseases that are part of the metabolic syndrome, which will directly affect both your physical and mental health. Metabolic syndrome is the smorgasbord of chronic metabolic diseases from which America and indeed the entire world now suffers. To name them, how about heart disease, hypertension, blood lipid problems such as hypertriglyceridemia, type 2 diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, chronic kidney disease, polycystic ovarian disease, cancer, and dementia. These are the diseases of insulin resistance, where insulin can't clear glucose from the blood properly, while fat precipitates in your liver and muscles. Next time you're at the butcher, have him show you strip steak from a grass-fed cow and a corn-fed cow. The grass-fed steak is pink and pretty homogeneous throughout. It's delicious, but when you grill it up, it's a little tough. Now look at the corn-fed steak. See all that marbling? We love it, because that's where the flavor is. And after grilling, it practically cuts with a butter knife. That marbling is fat in the muscle. That's muscle insulin resistance. That cow had metabolic syndrome. We just happened to slaughter it before it got sick. And now we're consuming the after effects in each and every Big Mac. What am I? Chopped liver? At the cellular level, the avalanche of energy from a processed food meal overwhelms your liver's cellular power generators, the mitochondria. When these liver mitochondria get overloaded, they have no choice but to turn the extra energy into liver fat. These molecules of liver fat have one of two fates. Either, one, your liver can package them into very low-density lipoproteins, or VLDL, which can lead to heart disease and obesity, and which your doctor can measure as serum triglycerides on your lab panel. Or, two, your liver can't package them, they turn into fat droplets, and they make your liver sick. A sick liver does not respond well to insulin, causing the pancreas to have to release extra insulin. Eventually, your pancreas gives out, and now you have type 2 diabetes. You've got metabolic syndrome, and you are losing years of life as your cells and your body age more quickly. How can all this be happening when you're dieting and buying low-fat products? Well, that's just what causes it. That's what's happened to America and the world. We lowered the fat and put in more sugar to make our food palatable, and all of that increased sugar in the diet is a leading contributing factor to metabolic syndrome. I wrote a whole book about it, Fat Chance. People with metabolic syndrome have decreased serotonin function and are at very high risk for depression. And not because they're fat, because thin people get metabolic syndrome also, with the underlying phenomena of insulin resistance and liver fat. They're called TOFI, T-O-F-I, or thin on the outside, fat on the inside. Furthermore, each of the disease components, that is, lipid problems and glucose intolerance, correlates with depression even better than abdominal obesity does. The foods that drive metabolic syndrome are those that are most clearly associated with the foods that people with binge eating disorder consume with the greatest avidity: refined carbs and sugar. The question is, does the depression drive the food choices which then drive the metabolic syndrome? Or do the food choices drive the metabolic syndrome which then drives the depression? Which is the cause and which is the effect? We still don't know. But what we do know is that some people can eat their way out of both the metabolic disease and out of the depression by switching to a Mediterranean diet. And why not? Lots of eggs, fish, nuts, fiber, and not very much refined carbohydrate or sugar. The fact that your food choices can lift your mood certainly argues that food is the driver. The slippery slope. Not only is metabolic syndrome related to depression, it's also related to cognitive decline. And nothing will make you more depressed than losing your intelligence. We've known for a long time that people with type 2 diabetes demonstrate cognitive decline, and that brain insulin resistance correlates with dementia, like Alzheimer's disease. Yet, type 1 diabetes, which is a spontaneously occurring disease, as opposed to type 2, which is driven in part by sugar in the diet, does not correlate with dementia. Both forms of diabetes share high blood glucose as the primary phenomenon, but type 1 diabetics are deficient in insulin, while type 2 diabetics have too much insulin but are resistant to its actions. Because it's not the glucose, it's the insulin. The insulin resistance, driven by all that excess soda and sugar-laden foods, is what leads to the brain plaques that define Alzheimer's disease. When you're healthy and insulin sensitive, the insulin rise from a meal normally tells the brain that you've had enough food. But once metabolic syndrome sets in, the chronic insulin in the brain does exactly the opposite. It blocks the signal to stop eating. Worse yet, the insulin resistance alone, unrelated to blood glucose, predicts cognitive impairment and the risk for Alzheimer's disease. It's always been assumed that dementia and cognitive decline are the province of the aged. Not so. Antonio Convit at NYU School of Medicine has shown that teenagers with metabolic syndrome, matched by age, socioeconomic level, school grade, gender, and ethnicity, manifest cognitive decline, brain shrinkage, and decreased white matter integrity. And these kids don't even have type 2 diabetes yet. But they will. In fact, this is a positive feedback cycle. The more brain insulin resistance they develop, the more their dopamine neurons fire, the less restraint of the reward system, your inner Jiminy Cricket from Chapter 4, the more their anxiety, the less their cognitive inhibition, the more food, especially sugar, that they consume, and the more insulin resistance they will develop. Ultimately, this vicious cycle culminates in diabetes, dementia, and often depression. Indeed, dietary sugar, sucrose consisting of glucose and fructose, rather than blood sugar, glucose only, is the driver in this scenario because dietary sugar underlies insulin resistance and insulin resistance underlies dementia. If you feed fructose to animals, you get all of the pathology and the cognitive decline one sees in Alzheimer's disease. And it causes changes in genes that predict Alzheimer's. So far in humans, we only have correlation. For instance, sugar consumption correlates with risk for dementia in epidemiologic studies. But we know correlation is not causation. In humans, we still don't have cause and effect. Does sugar consumption make you lose brain cells, including those that house your serotonin receptors? Or does losing brain cells make you consume more sugar? Both, most likely. But today, we just can't say for sure. Nonetheless, are you comfortable with the risk? By driving reward, sugar drives risk for addiction, and addiction culminates in unhappiness. Both high glycemic index diets, that is, highly refined carbohydrate from processed foods, and high added sugar diets are correlated with depression. But again, correlation is not causation. Does sugar cause depression, or do depressed people consume sugar to give themselves what little pleasure that they can muster? There is no doubt that Kathy Geiswite's eponymous cartoon character Kathy is both depressed and a chocoholic. But are these related, and which caused which? Is sugar consumption a contributor to the depressed state? Or is addiction a necessary intermediate step between sugar consumption and depression? The answer to all of these is a definite maybe. Your gut feeling. But the more immediate question for all of us, is your sugar consumption really under your control? Common wisdom says you're in control of every item that you put in your mouth. And common sense would also suggest that this is true. Except we know from part two that in addiction, you're not really in control. The drugs are doing the talking via dopamine. What if something else is also talking, feeding your brain with devious and distracting thoughts, like your bacteria? You might think that your gut microbiome, consisting of 100 trillion bacteria representing several hundred species and residing in your intestine, would not be immediately connected to your brain. Nonetheless, your gut microbiome appears to have a mind of its own, and it very well may control yours. Every person on Earth harbors his or her own individual Amazon rainforest, with unique creatures living on and in them. The bacterial species found within a person's gut can identify him or her by a unique microbial signature. Yet, the human gut microbiome is very clearly and rapidly responsive, within as little as 2 days, to dietary manipulation. And why not? Different nutrients will make their way farther down the intestine based on different aspects of the diet, such as what carbohydrates you're consuming, whether those carbohydrates are fermented, and whether they are accompanied by the corresponding fiber inherent in that food. Different bacteria like to grow in different dietary soups to different extents. In fact, changes in the microbiome have been associated with increased risk for obesity in both directions. For instance, transferring obesogenic bacteria from one mouse strain to another can cause the recipient mouse to become obese. This was anecdotally demonstrated in a human, where an unfortunate woman who received a fecal transplant to treat her infectious diarrhea became massively obese afterward. Conversely, ingestion of certain strains of probiotics, that is, friendly bacteria, or prebiotics, dietary components such as fiber that let friendly bacteria grow, have been associated with weight loss and improvement in certain disease states. Other studies have found probiotics can influence mood and cognition. Microbial diversity may be protective against the various diseases of metabolic syndrome and obesity, and possibly depression. Your bacteria talk loud and clear, and apparently your brain listens. Remember, 90% of the serotonin made in your body is used by the gut for various purposes. Serotonin happens to be pretty versatile. Only 1% of your total body serotonin is in your brain, impacting, among other things, your level of well-being and contentment. Apparently, a happy gut means a happy you. These bacteria may alter our emotional state and our dietary preferences through indirect communication with the emotion centers within our brain. The one undeniable fact is that of all the items in the grocery store, sugar is the only one that is independently associated with depression and addiction and metabolic syndrome. And, as we've already noted, it's undoubtedly the cheapest way to pleasure and the surest path to unhappiness. But fear not, there does appear to be one dietary item that can mitigate the damage that sugar does to the brain and promote the biochemistry and processes that can predispose us to happiness. And perhaps not surprisingly, its presence in the diet correlates positively with tryptophan and negatively with sugar. So, what is this magic chemical? It's omega-3 fatty acids, of all things, a type of fat, something we were told to avoid 40 years ago. Another item that's pretty hard to come by in the Western diet. Perhaps this is another reason that happiness has eluded so many of us. Brain food. Omega-3s come in two main flavors, eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, or DHA. Everyone thinks that these two omega-3s are found in fish. Well, they are, but there are some qualifications to that statement. Fish don't make omega-3s. Fish eat omega-3s. Rather, omega-3s are made by green leafy plants, either in the sea or on land. Algae are the best source of omega-3s around. The fish eat the algae, we eat the fish. So we purchase our omega-3s secondhand, and at a premium to boot. But wild fish eat algae. Farmed fish eat pellets. Sometimes the pellets are made from other fish, which, even if they ate algae, are now pretty diluted. Sometimes they're made from corn. Since farmed fish are fatter, see, happens to them as well, they have a slightly higher omega-3 content, but their omega-6 content, which drives inflammation, is extremely high. Thus, wild fish is a more expensive but smarter choice. The pop literature surrounding omega-3s has translated into people popping fish oil capsules left and right. Full disclosure, I do too. There is even a purified omega-3 preparation available by prescription, called Loveza, but it's very expensive and usually not covered by insurance. In fact, I take care of children with severely elevated blood triglycerides, high enough to cause spontaneous acute pancreatitis, which is a mega disaster with life-threatening complications. Purified omega-3s are the obvious treatment of choice, and still the insurance companies won't authorize their purchase. So what's behind this miracle superfood that does so much? Omega-3s are incorporated into cell membranes throughout your body. They increase membrane fluidity, which means that they allow for easy cell deformation, allowing them to snap back instead of rupturing. This prevents cell aging and early cell death. They also allow nutrients and hormones to pass through the cell membrane and allow toxins to leave the cell rapidly. Nowhere in the body is this special function more important than in the brain. For instance, omega-3s help repair the damage to membranes exerted by glucose, and especially fructose. That's all well and good, but what do omega-3s have to do with serotonin, or with the promotion of happiness for that matter? Turns out, omega-3s impact our mental well-being in two distinct but related ways. First, omega-3s have an indirect effect on serotonin release from nerve terminals throughout the brain. When the area surrounding the nerve terminal releasing serotonin is inflamed, it inhibits serotonin release, the keys, and even fewer are able to make their way to the receptors, the locks, across the synapse. This may explain why people whose bodies and brains are undergoing inflammation tend to be so irritable, even if they're taking an SSRI. There is even less serotonin for them to work with. But omega-3s inhibit the formation of inflammatory cells, which presumably would allow for better serotonin transmission. Second, DHA, one of the omega-3s, is a precursor of a class of molecules called endocannabinoids, the brain and body's version of marijuana. As we discussed with Rimonabant in Chapter 2, we have specific receptors for marijuana called CB1 receptors, which are ubiquitous throughout the brain. The active compound in marijuana, known as tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, binds to the CB1 receptor to heighten mood by alleviating anxiety, which explains why people are so giddy when they smoke pot. Turns out our neurons make their own marijuana-like neuromodulator called anandamide, which binds to that CB1 receptor, which is designed to alleviate our level of anxiety. Anything that inhibits anandamide synthesis or action will increase your level of anxiety several-fold, while anything that improves anandamide's action will keep you cool as a cucumber. Most of us are prone to experience anxiety and stress. An extra boost of occupancy of your CB1 receptors by smoking pot might allay some of that anxiety if you aren't prone to paranoia when you're stoned. And, as you might expect, as our collective stress and anxiety levels have continued to increase, our level of happiness has continued to decrease. The increase in anxiety is one reason for the increasing number of potheads nationwide and provides a rational explanation for why recreational marijuana legislation is spreading throughout the United States. Our own anandamide clearly isn't enough to tame the wild beast anymore. Why not? Well, omega-3s are part of the endocannabinoid signaling machinery. Deficiency of omega-3s doesn't allow endocannabinoids to act as they normally would on the system, thus causing more anxiety and depression. But the converse also seems to be true. We can fix this problem with omega-3 supplementation. In one study, a Mediterranean diet improved symptoms of depression. Well, was it the omega-3s? Or less processed sugar-laden food? One study showed that omega-3s were equivalent in effect to Prozac in treating depression, and the combination was more effective than either one alone. In a related study, administration of omega-3s to patients with recurrent self-harm, like cutting, picking, scratching, burning, you know, which is the ultimate expression of anxiety, showed a reduction in suicidality, depression, and daily stress. A recent trial gave omega-3s along with minerals to 11-year-old kids with conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, you know, the ones that routinely find themselves in the principal's office. And within 3 months, their aggression was reduced and way better than talk therapy. Lastly, omega-3 consumption can help ward off depression in children and adults and serve as an adjunct to SSRIs in its treatment. And this is the gift that keeps on giving, or should I say the punishment that keeps on punishing? What your mother ate makes a difference in who you are. Many mothers state that their child's health and happiness are at the forefront of their own life goals. Well, what you eat when pregnant plays a large part in determining your child's future. Lack of omega-3s during pregnancy in rats alters the offspring's brains in a way that messes with insulin signaling and brain growth factor levels, all of which lead to increased anxiety behaviors. This has immediate implications for all of us. What do we tell pregnant women not to eat? Seafood, because of the concern for mercury poisoning. Except that maternal seafood consumption predicts improved neurodevelopmental outcomes in British children. Are we making more trouble than we are solving? Well, maybe we can skirt this issue by giving pregnant women some omega-3 capsules. If we do, the kids' neurodevelopmental outcomes and the mom's risk for depression are improved. New research suggests that walnuts might also be beneficial. We are such stuff as dreams are made on. There you have it. The dietary trifecta of happiness. Tryptophan, sugar, omega-3s. Three individual components in our diet, two of which are essential nutrients and hard to get, the tryptophan and omega-3s. And the third, added sugar, which is not even a food, but nonetheless has been purposely placed in virtually everything you eat and drink. Three separate mechanisms, but with a very clear interplay among all of them. The balance of these three molecules is the difference between a healthy, happy, and agile brain and an angry, sad, and demented one. And maybe your child's angry, sad, and cognitively compromised brain as well. The two that help alleviate depression are in short supply anyway, and even less so in processed food. Conversely, the component that destroys the brain has been added to virtually every processed food item for palatability and sales. Our Western diet has done us no favors in our ever-elusive quest for happiness. But just listen on. The true key to our unhappiness lies in our insatiable quest for pleasure. It gets worse before it gets better.